Okay, thanks everybody, and welcome to another edition of Conversations with Dr. Cowan and Friends. And today I have a new friend, which is whose name I think I'll get it right, Maureen McMichael. And it's an interesting story of how. So Maureen is joining our new biology clinic. So this is sort of the series of Maureen, how I introduce people, or we introduce people to our members and people who might want to be members. And Maureen is a vet. Now, if you had asked me 4 years ago if I would ever be part of a medical thing or initiative, or it's, I don't even know if it's medical really, but whatever it is, we're doing clinic, that we're helping people with health issues. And you say, Tom, would you ever want a vet to be part of your initiative? I would say, I don't know. Why would we do that? So now we're talking 3 or 3.5 years ago, and you may have heard this story, but then Pumpkin came into my life. And I had never had an emotional connection with an animal before. That means I lived 63-ish years. I had a cat when I was growing up named Tammy, who was a little weird, and I didn't have much to do with her. There was a house I lived in with a dog that I didn't have much to do with. I had chickens on and off in different places I lived. And because I often was connected with biodynamic farms, I, you know, was around cows and sheep and goats and chickens and cats and dogs a lot. But I never had any relationship with any of them. And so then we moved here and we put in a big garden and we put in a pasture and we made a barn. So we were going to raise sheep. And then somebody said, well, you need cats and chickens. So we had chickens because otherwise they cats keep the mice away. And I had been familiar a little with barn cats, you know, so I thought we got these two cats, two litter mates, Pumpkin and Fluffy, boy and a girl. I'll tell you how ignorant I was in a minute. From a biodynamic friend, and they had been, you know, living in the barn. They were like 8 weeks old, and we took them home. And I thought I was going to put them in the barn and maybe feed them once a week, and that's the end of it. A couple days later, Pumpkin kind of crawls up into my leg and wants me to hold him. And then he did that pretty much every day after every single meal. Next thing you know, I mean, I'm figuring out how to feed this guy, you know, with the best. So originally I was just, you know, biodynamic raw hamburger and steak and I'd cut up and et cetera. And he would spend about a half an hour to an hour just with me, following me around, sitting on my lap, and not with my wife. He didn't seem to have much to do. And that changed a lot. And there's a whole lot of stories after that. Now, of course, Pumpkin sleeps in our bed, and they have two children. They've had two litters, and we kept two, PJ and Lucy. And just to show how ignorant I was, so they were brother and sister, right? And I thought they wouldn't mate, because they obviously knew better. And I remember going out one day and I thought, uh-oh. And next thing you know, we had four kittens and we gave those away. And next thing you know, we had six more kittens. And then it started to look like a problem. And all that's to say is I went from having almost no interest, not that I didn't care about animals, you know, but now, and the what I see happening with animals, I mean, it's, and once you have this kind of connection, when you start seeing that, it's a whole different story. It's like, not okay, some animal. I mean, now, I mean, we were out this morning, there's a chicken that had some blood on it, and I don't know why, and et cetera. And you know, we're putting up lights and fixed. We made a whole new barn because the cats didn't want to sleep in the barn with the goats because it smells like goat That was a $10,000 barn just for two cats. I mean, I just, anyways, you can now see why I'm thrilled to have somebody who knows more than me, which, by the way, isn't saying much. But I've learned an incredible amount. And I'll finish with just the word my wife, Linda, and I often say, if everybody in the world was like PJ, the world would be a lot better place. Because, you know, once when his sister was hurt, he would just go up and sit with her and lick her. And he just is the friendliest. And he runs off and chases mice and does his, you know. So he's not like, I don't know. You could just see that. And so it's very profound. So I don't think I'm the only one who wants to talk to a vet who might actually have some sense. And I know I don't want to get into, you know, criticizing vets too much, but yeah, so that's my intro. So welcome, and maybe just introduce yourself. And I ask that everybody who joins this, who I do an interview, this being the clinic, I say, why on the world would somebody with your pretty amazing credentials want to join this new biology clinic, for God's sake, you know? Like, anyways, welcome. We are thrilled to have you. And if you could just tell us a little bit about how you ended up even thinking about joining us, that would be great.
Sure, sure. So I'm Maureen McMichael, and I grew up in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yep. All over New York City. Born in Brooklyn, grew up in Staten Island, went to school in Manhattan. And I didn't really have much of a, I think this is relevant. I grew up very poor. Wow. Single mom at points. There were a few times we lived in a car, like really, truly, honestly poor.
Wow.
And I went to inner city high school. Not really any education happening, essentially, at all, really. And when I was done with that, I always knew that I wanted to be a vet, but that didn't seem possible. And the nice thing is,
always since when would you say?
Since I was that I can remember being 5 or 6, and being in my little front yard. And a dog came by, a Great Dane, and I brought him in the yard, and I started bandaging him up. He didn't need bandaging. He probably right. didn't want bandaging.
Yeah, right.
Much bigger than I was. And my mother came out and almost had a heart attack. She just said, step away from the dog. And that's like my earliest memory of knowing that I wanted to do that.
Wow. And you had the sense, my guess is that you could bandage this dog and he wasn't going to bot. He's just was going to.
Yeah, he was just fine, which is amazing. Yeah. Really, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty fun. And my mother was my role model because she later in life went back to school. She also had no education. She went back to school and became a nurse. And I think that was what showed me it was possible. And, you know, fortunately, I was ignorant enough to just step forward. I was at a local community college. I asked them, how do you get into vet school? And they said, you don't. So he said, the best chance you have is to go to Manhattan, the big island, and apply to one of those schools. So I applied to a bunch of schools in Manhattan, including Columbia. And because to me, Columbia was just another school in Manhattan.
You're talking about college or vet school?
College, Columbia University for undergrad, to be able to get into vet school.
Right. Yeah.
So I got into Columbia and...
Wow.
They have a program, a fabulous program for non-traditional students in general studies where it's relatively easy to get in. It's just really hard to stay in.
Yeah.
It's a pre-med. We started with 250 students and ended with 30 or 40, something like that. Anyway, then got into Cornell Vet School, graduated, knew I wanted emergency medicine, and did an internship.
So you were obviously a good student. That's why you could be one of the 30.
I was very persistent.
Got it.
Went and did an internship in Rochester, New York, and then a residency at Tufts in emergency critical care.
Wow.
And got boarded and knew that I wanted academia. And I knew that I wanted academia because I really wanted to continue learning. I love learning. I could just learn. I'm just at my happiest when I'm learning. And then I went into academia. And
let me just stop you there. And by the way, I don't mean to be rude, but it's interesting for me if you're okay. So yeah. What we're really saying is, Cornell Vet School is like the top vet school maybe in the world. So, and to be an emergency trained vet, we're talking, you were about as high up in the vet totem pole at that point as you could get.
High up.
And still, correct me if I'm wrong, but you still, quote, believed in all the usual vet stuff at that point.
Yes, I did. I did.
I mean, you know, that's just, I don't mean that as a criticism. I just mean, it's just part of the biography.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, my mother was way ahead of her time. She was in true. If she knew about Weston A. Price, she would have been a member.
Wow.
She was into Adele Davis and all of the health stuff. And so I learned to be skeptical pretty early, which was helpful.
Yeah. So you had inklings that there's more to life.
But yes.
Yeah, like a lot of people, you weren't clear where to go with it.
That's right. And part of the issue, I think, with schooling is you have to memorize so much information that you don't have a lot of time to think. There's no critical thinking time.
Right. Yeah. Really. That's the word. That's not part of medicine.
No. And it's worse. I think it's worse. So I think my biggest schism occurred during the fentanyl crisis, which sounds crazy, but fentanyl crisis kicks in.
So you're now board certified emergency care vet, and so then and interested in academia. So then you worked in academia or somewhere?
Yeah, I went to Texas A&M and I started the first emergency clinic at the university.
Wow.
And that was great, fabulous experience, wonderful people, really great first job.
This is all kinds of animals, small animals, horses, dogs, cats.
Dogs, cats, exotics, not large animals.
Not cows.
Yeah. And I'll say Texas A&M had a fabulous first responder group. So there were first responders and search and rescue people that had dogs. And I got to work with them. And that was probably the impetus for later what I got into, but really interesting people. And they have a place called Disaster City, which is, you've never seen anything like it. Like, you drive through and there are Amtrak's falling off bridges and there's a tugboat in on fire, and it's just absolutely fabulous. And they would have live real dogs do their work there, so they would have students volunteers as bodies. Students would volunteer as hurt, you know, in the Amtrak, and the dogs would have to find them. And that was just so much fun.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. So then I moved on to the University of Illinois, and the fentanyl crisis kicked in.
What year are we talking about?
Let's see. So 2007. I moved there in 2007. So probably 2009, 2010, 2011. A number of dogs, search and rescue, mostly drug sniffing dogs, got into fentanyl and collapsed.
Uh-huh.
because they're sniffing. And so we got.
I mean, they didn't ingest it. They just smelled it.
Yeah.
And they collapsed.
Yeah, I actually think that it's probably not pure fentanyl. I think some of it is carfentanil. So carfentanil is 10,000 times more potent than fentanyl.
Wow.
Or actually than morphine. So it's very, very, very potent. So I think that's part of what they're mixing in with some of this stuff. So we got, I got, and a couple of other ER vets got a lot of requests to go out to train in the field, train what happens if the dog gets into fentanyl, what do we do in the field? And that expanded to what happens if the dog gets heat stroke in the field? What happens if the dog gets bit by a snake in the field or stabbed or shot? And so that evolved into a really, what for me, what was really interesting, field medicine, which means there's no fancy equipment, there's no fancy blood work. It's just you and the animal. What do you do? There's a rattlesnake. What do you do? And
let me stop you there for a minute. So at this point, would you say that you had like, did you have dogs and you were like, you know, raising dog and connected with dogs or cats or other animals otherwise?
Yeah, I've had dogs my whole life.
Got it. Yeah.
And mostly German Shepherds, just by coincidence. Well, every single dog I've ever had has been some kind of a dump, you know, like the dogs get dumped at the ER or a rescue or something like that. Except for my last failed attempt at canine birth control, but we won't go there.
Right.
Just skip that. And so the what was happening is a schism. So I'm out in the field, I'm doing this stuff that feels very authentic, and it's also stretching me. I love learning. I'm learning, like, what do you do with a rattlesnake in the field? At the same time, I'm in the classroom on other days teaching academic veterinary medicine, where I'm teaching the students to memorize cytokines, the names, right?
Yeah.
And I'm literally, I felt like I was rolling my eyes inside my head as I was speaking. I was boring myself. And saying, why am I doing, like, why am I telling them this? This is irrelevant. So that was the big schism. And I really started going a lot more toward the field work and being much more interested in that.
Yeah. Okay.
And that launched into another whole series of how to keep working dogs safe and healthy from the get-go. How do you keep them healthy? And that launched into food and diet and sleep and exercise and movement and all of that. And that really became my passion. And again, because we're out in the field, we're not talking about medications. We're talking about herbs. We're talking about, so here's just an example. First responders in Texas, when they're going into the woods with their dog, will grab plantain, not the banana, the leaf, you know, right? They grab handfuls of it and put it in their pocket.
You mean routinely, they know that that's potentially useful.
That's right.
That's just common knowledge for a first responder in Texas.
That's right. That's right. And if the dog gets bit by a snake, you make a little poultice, you chop up the plantain. A lot of people put it in their mouth, spit it out, you know, chew it up, spit it up, put it on there. And I recently had the experience of being able to do that on my dog. She was bit by a copperhead and her face swelled, her paws swelled. I put the plantain on and it was, and I can only say this because I've treated hundreds of copperhead bites and I know it takes 3 days for the swelling to go down. My dog's swelling was down in probably 4 hours. It started really going down and within 12 hours, it was completely gone.
And that was from putting a poultice on the site of the bite.
That's correct. Plantain will literally draw out those toxins.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So that became my main issue and my main interest.
So you go from plantain for snake bites to what if a dog falls and hurts its leg, or what if it gets caught, or what if it gets a cut, or then what if a cat gets a cut, or that sort of thing.
Yes, yes. And what do you do out there? What do you do? And a simple, just simple for bleeding, cayenne pepper works really well, which is, you know, who knew? Who knew that was something we could use for bleeding? So there's lots of field medicine that is very practical, very inexpensive, and quite safe.
Yeah. So it sounds like then you're starting to evolve a, if you're going with your dog or your cat, you have in your, you have like pocket of plantain and cayenne pepper and probably three or four other little things in there, honey maybe, and that's how you deal with what might happen to an animal.
Yeah. And so having those things on hand, and you know, depending on where a person is, growing it, you know, growing. So I'm growing turmeric. I grow ginger and turmeric here, you know, and being able to use turmeric as an anti-inflammatory is fabulous.
Yeah.
I think it's just, yeah. Yeah.
So at that point, then you're evolving a more of a sort of natural approach to treating animals, especially like in the field, like acute care medicine, I guess you would call it.
Yes.
What about where did you start thinking differently about, well, there's a lot of dogs and animals who get cancer or whatever, leukemia, you know, that is that just the way it goes, or is there something we can think about this differently or do differently, or what, when did that start, or if it started, which I think I know it did start.
That started. I want to say that started a long time ago, but I have to say, I don't know why the COVID thing, we weren't gone for very long. The hospital closed for a short period of time for ER. I think ER was closed 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month. And
where you're currently working.
Yeah. And I don't know why that month, I'm not sure what happened, but when I went back, I really became very acutely aware that we don't even ask why anymore. It's just almost all of the chronic conditions that I can think of are treated by suppressing symptoms.
Yeah.
So it's all about how to make the diagnosis, what tests you need, and then what drugs you need to suppress the symptoms. But nobody is even asking, why do they get this?
Yeah.
And that just, it was very, it was quite a shock to realize how prevalent it is, you know? And I think it's lifestyle, diet. It's just like it is for us.
Yeah.
And diet, movement, sleep, all of that.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong too, with animals, it's a lot to do with their, whatever you call it, mental, emotional environment that they're living in.
Yeah. Yeah. Very important. Very important. Yeah.
And how they're treated and just the care or lack of it, or, you know, and whether they're something like honored as, you know, a dog or a cat.
Yes, yes, yes. But also, you know, I believe that the owner's fear about the animal, what could be wrong with the animal, that fear feeds into the condition. And I think that there's a real clear connection there in being able to alleviate their fear. And alleviating it with, you know, just basic knowledge of foundational health, and then other options of if something happens, you know, what would I need to be prepared to do? I think that can help a lot.
Yeah. And so did you start coming to conclusions about like the proper way to feed a dog or a cat, or do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah. I think that's so important. I think we start with diet. Diet, really, really important. And part of diet is fasting. None of our animals were meant to eat all the time, you know, free choice or anything. None of them were meant to eat all the time. And there were always in the wild periods of fasting. And most people now are feeding their animals continuously. And there's a new drug that's coming out. It's getting a lot of press. It's a drug that is touted that it will increase canine lifespan. It's an insulin-like growth factor inhibitor. It's not even approved yet, but it's all over the press. And people are talking about it. Clients are talking about it. Vets are talking, everybody's talking about it. And all it is really is that what you can achieve is to fast the dog, you can achieve what this drug would achieve. So periods of fat, and it's actually quite easy. I won't tell you that my dogs like it, but I fast. And when I'm fasting, they fast. Now they don't fast as long as I fast. All I do is skip a meal once in a while. It's pretty simple. And I think it's really important. I think it's really, really important that they go for periods of time where they'll have autophagy happening, where they're cleaning up everything.
Yeah. So this is dogs and cats?
Yeah. Yeah. Cats. I don't think cats are meant to eat continuously either.
We say continuously, like twice a day is continuously.
Yeah. I think twice a day is probably fine. I say probably start with 2 days a week where it's just once a day.
Got it.
And then
what about in if animal, I'm a little bit asking for myself now, the animals are, it's cold out, you know, and it's 10 degrees and they're sleeping in the barn with maybe access to a little heat lamp or something. Do you still do that or do they need more food then?
They probably need more food at the main meal.
Yeah.
The one meal, but then they still could skip.
Got it.
Now cats are different. I'll tell you, cats are different, but one meal is not going to do this, but cats do have hepatic lipidosis. You know, they, I think that's partially a nutrition thing though, as well. But if cats go a longer period, days, 5 days, 6 days without eating, they'll end up getting fatty liver.
Got it. So skipping a meal with a cat.
Yeah. Yeah. A meal would be okay. Five days.
Yeah. And a dog is something like that too. Skip two meals a week, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you have, and so one of the things that we're going to do here is you're going to give to the members and the people part of the clinic, you're going to give talks on food, which would, it's not just including this fasting, but you know, well, Maureen, what do I feed my dog? You know, like kind of kibble should I use or something?
Right. Yeah. Use the round kibble, not the square kibble. So what I've done is I've created a food ladder, and the food ladder starts at the bottom with the worst possible food you can give. And it goes all the way to the top, which is the, you know, organic, ancestral, biodynamic, regenerative, etc. And the goal would be for people to figure out where they already are on that ladder and then try to move up a rung.
Yeah.
Just make it doable, because we can't all feed, you know, just cook for our animals or go to the biodynamic farm and get the raw, you know, organic meat and bring it home every day. And so having people, I'm making it accessible. So people are going to figure out where they are and what they can do. And then there's also going to be like a menu of options that can be added to increase health. Like turmeric, it's fabulous for joint health. And if turmeric is added as a powder, as opposed to pills, it causes the taste on the tongue can cause bile flow to increase,
yeah,
which also helpful. So that kind of stuff, like pick and choose some of these options to add.
So in other words, like the optimal diet for a cat or a dog might be, and you know, not everybody can do this, but you know, fresh, biodynamic or pasture raised meat that's mostly raw, I would think. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's even bigger than that. I mean, if you go all the way to the very top of the ladder, a cat wouldn't eat beef.
Yeah, right.
Because it's rare to see a cat take a cow down.
Yeah, right. Right. Unless it's a really big cat.
And you know, so the type of food, like rabbit seems to be really good for cats. That's yeah. something they can definitely catch, they can do. So that sort of, and of course mice, you know, yeah. going down and that kind of stuff. And dog, it would be, again, not cow, ideally, you know, dog yeah. is, sheep is really good for dogs.
Yeah.
I just read that, I never really made this connection. Sheep cannot be factory farmed. So they just, I don't know why, but they can't.
Yeah,
be.
They don't do well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so sheep meat in general tends to always be grass-fed or pasture-raised.
Right.
So it's even if it's not organic, for the price, that tends to be a good food for dogs.
Got it. So essentially what we're talking about is the, you know, for dogs and cats in particular, it's whatever the best meat you can get. Sometimes you can, and then you probably talk about organs and bones and
yes.
And then you, if you have put different herbs in it, powders, little green things, what to add. And then you end up with hopefully an animal that doesn't get sick.
That's right. That's right. Ideally. Yes, 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 yes. But you know, there's a lot of fear around feeding pets. And I really don't know, because we don't have the same fear around feeding us. Like we never sit down and say, is this the perfect meal? Does this have every vitamin and every nutrient that I need? And yet people are convinced you have to buy the packaged food because that is all the nutrients they need. And
right.
So it's an interesting dichotomy there.
Got it. And so then, and that's not the only thing. There's like, you can't, a cat can't just sit around all day, or a dog, you know,
that's right. Movement.
They need to move and do the things that dogs and cats do, which.
That's right. Yes. And grounding is so important for them, and sun and circadian rhythm and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what you're going to get into then, in addition to how to treat acute illness, this is now, we're talking prevention of chronic illness with animals.
Yeah, so there's going to be a foundational series, which will be diet, sleep, and
that's great.
And then it'll be specifics like joint health, heart health, cognitive health, and then it will be common emergencies and sort of what to have on hand and that. Yeah, so it'll be a whole series.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that gives people an idea. Is there other things you want to let our people know, or just about the way you see animal health, or anything, you know, parting words, so to speak?
I think that fear makes everything worse.
Yeah.
And I think having a toolbox, you know, a combination of homeopathy and herbs and all of that can help alleviate some of that fear. The truth is, most of the animals that have some kind of an acute injury, as long as it's not life-threatening, will heal themselves just fine. Yeah. It's sometimes we need to do the things for them. Sometimes we need to put the honey in the wound or know what herb to give. But it might be more for us.
Yeah.
They have an amazing healing ability.
You know, I tell a story like that, which I don't know if you've heard this, but maybe 4 or 5 months after I got Pumpkin, and you know, he had never been away he from this farm to our barn. At that point, he'd never been anywhere else. So And he was going all over the place, you know, I don't know where he went. So one day he comes home with a big slit in his ear. And I thought, well, because I told Pumpkin he's going to go to the vet the day after I go to the doctor, which was last time was like 25 years ago. So it's been a while. So I didn't do anything and he seemed fine, you know, big slit in his ear and I don't know. But I just looked at him and he seemed fine and he ate and everything. And then he went off for a day or so, which was a little bit unusual. And I thought, oh, well, I don't know what happened to him. And then he comes home looking normal and his whole ear was hard as a rock. And I remember thinking, I was an ER doctor myself, you know, for people. And okay, you know, he's got like a quote infection in his ear. I don't know what I'm going to do about this, but he seemed fine. So I didn't do anything. Then he goes off and I didn't see him for like 3 days. And that was really unusual. So I'm thinking he's dead in the woods. It went to his brain. And he comes back and his ear is pus, the whole ear. And he seemed fine. So he went off. Comes back the next day, ear is normal with a little bit of a red spot in it. So apparently the pus drained and he never seemed to have bothered him at all. And then it, you know, maybe a month later, you couldn't tell which ear it was. So he didn't do anything. Here's what I thought at that point was in my 37-year career as a medical doctor, including, you know, working in ERs a little bit in the early, I never once saw a infected ear like that wasn't given antibiotics or drain it. Not once. I've never seen it. Now, I remember telling people and hearing people say, if you don't get this antibiotic or drain surgically, it's going to go to your brain and kill you. That's what we told. Nobody that I knew ever saw that happen.
Oh,
Right?
wow.
I never saw it go to anybody's brain. I never saw it not treated with an antibiotic. Truth be told, I had no idea what would happen if you didn't treat it with an antibiotic, and neither did anybody else I ever met.
That's right.
And so my only experience, not with a person, because I don't know if I'd even do that with a person now, but with the only person I know who had that was Pumpkin. And we didn't do anything for her. I didn't put anything on it. You know, I don't know what he did, but it's fine. And I think every doctor needs to see that before they go around telling people, oh, you're going to have this happen, because you don't know that.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I'll say I think Pumpkin fasted.
But
My,
I, yeah.
yeah. And that's another big part of allowing them to fast when they're not eating, because that's the opposite of what happens when they come into a hospital. They get force fed
Yeah.
immediately, you know.
Right.
And but allowing them to fast so that they can reserve all their energy to heal, it's just beautiful. And also, there's something about reactivating the fear, you know, that you see a pet owner and you've got this ear and you run to the hospital. Now the animal's terrified. And
Yeah.
then, you know, we do some kind of surgical procedure and we're constantly going back at that ear,
Yeah.
constantly.
Yeah.
So it's fear and fear, more fear and more fear. And it takes longer to heal, I think.
Yeah. Right. I mean, all I did was look at it, you know. I didn't even really touch it. I could see, you know, what was happening. But yeah, the fear is a huge part of it. And the fasting too. I heard a story the other day of a cat who got bitten by a really poisonous snake, who went and found a stream and sat in the stream and ate some grass in the stream and puked, threw up for 3 days. Then walked out fine. And that was supposedly a 100% fatal snake bite. That cat knew, get throw it up, get rid of the bile, and cool off his body, probably in the stream.
Yeah,
And
yeah. Woo.
Yeah, we have a lot to learn from watching these little friends.
We do. You know, there's a cow doctor I listen to that I really like, and they asked her, what do you do when a cow gets sick? And she said, open the gate.
Yeah, right.
Because the cow will go find the herbs it
Yeah,
needs if I open the gate. Yeah.
That's yeah. All right, Maureen. Well, we're thrilled to have you, and thanks for doing this. And my guess is you're going to get filled up in the first hour, and then we'll have to figure out where to go from there.
Okay. Thank
All
you
right.
so much. Thank you.
Okay. We'll be in touch. Bye-bye.